Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Charles Lewis. He has been an investigative producer for ABC News and the CBS News program, 60 Minutes. He founded the Center for Public Integrity. He is executive editor of the Investigative Reporting Workshop at the American University School of Communication. And he is the author of a great new book I've recently read called 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. Chuck Lewis, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. I'm struck by the idea of a decline in America's moral integrity, because here is a nation built on slavery and war and genocide. You'd think we almost have to be gaining in moral integrity, but you seem to have documented pretty well a decline, at least in the past half century or so. Can you right. give the general outlines of what you're pointing to?
Well, no, you make an excellent point about the sordid history that goes back centuries. And I guess, you know, it feels like there's been a decline even since the middle part of the 20th century. But what was the good part of the moral integrity? There have been issues, as we both know, in the U.S. for many, many years. It started with my and many Americans' experience with the Iraq War, where turned out there was no there, the weapons of mass destruction rationale for war simply was not true and turned out to not be true. And I wrote the book because I noticed that close to 60% of the public still thought it was true about a year after we had been told, even by the president himself, that there were no weapons in Iraq. And so that got me thinking about the larger pattern going back many, many years. And everywhere I looked, I mean, in my own lifetime, that I had always pondered. And so it did fit suddenly an image of sort of wholesale, consistent misrepresentations by those in power. And really closely looking, it was government and major corporations. And again, I had known, obviously, elements of this here and there. But when you look at it cumulatively, it's a rather stunning array of untruth. And then you start to wonder, do we have any grasp whatsoever on today, this moment, and the future? And the ramifications are extremely sobering.
You know, I had very, very intelligent, educated people swear to me that the Iraq War in 2003 was the first war that a U.S. government had lied about. And I knew enough to think that might not quite be right. I'd heard about the Maine and the Lusitania. And I went and I looked through every war in history that I could find of this country and every other country. And I couldn't find one that hadn't been substantially lied about. I mean, was there an age when that was different?
Probably not. I mean, one of my early drafts of the manuscripts, I went back to the decimation of the Carthaginians by the Romans, and you know, whatever that is, 1,000 or 2,000 years ago.
Salt and, in the ground.
And basically, they asked the Carthaginians to lay down their arms and that they would be peaceful, and they had, meanwhile, the Roman Senate had voted to order their armies to go decimate the people and enslave 75,000 of them, et cetera. All that had been ordered days, weeks earlier, but no one in Carthage knew it. So I think war, you know, there's a wonderful book by Philip Knightley, the great investigative journalist in Britain, who wrote The First Casualty. It's a great book about truth and war, going back really to the beginning of human history, showing how whenever war is waged, truth is in short supply, shall we say. And it's a great famous quote by Senator Hiram Johnson back around 100 years ago that the first casualty of war is truth. And I think that's basically right as far as I can tell. I'm not an expert on all the wars, but it sure seems like there's a lot of that.
Yeah. The big difference may have been the quickly and demonstrably refutable claims that were used in the case of that war, and the weapons that weren't there. You also do a good job, I think, of documenting a serious decline, if not in government integrity, particularly in media integrity. And I've been watching these protests in Hong Kong on U.S. media, and I've always had this fantasy that the U.S. media would cover a protest, but it always seems to be in some foreign country when they do, some foreign country that the U.S. government happens to wish were protested. Would today's U.S. media even cover the civil rights movement in the U.S. South or show the Vietnam War in the way that it did at the time?
That's a great question. I was appalled in 2004 when thousands of people were prevented from demonstrating in New York City in the name of security, and any demonstrators were put in penned areas away from, they were literally thousands arrested, which there was litigation later, and basically there was a settlement, meaning they kind of knew they were doing that.
Yeah, they finally just got a bunch of money.
Yeah. So there is a significant problem here with demonstrating and in a number of cities, and that's been going on now, not just since 9/11, but most notably maybe since 9/11, where space and access is even further restricted in the name of security, and then the media will then not cover it, partly because they'll say they don't have access, but the fact is they don't exactly knock themselves out trying to get access. In many cases, they will listen to what the government says, and that'll be the story. And that is often the case, and that certainly was the case with 9/11. Not 9/11 itself, but the invasion of Iraq. That was a top-down story that most of the media did basically daily stenography of, writing down what was said, which is the public service to know what they're saying. That's relevant to history, and to the public needs to know that. But we all know that there was a significant lack of critical reporting. And when you go back to the other times, it turns out all the other so-called good old days, when you look closely, were not so good. I mean, in the case of civil rights, you know, there were 2,000 plus black newspapers in America, and they were covering every lynching. The New York Times didn't have a bureau in the southern part of the United States until 1947.
Yeah.
And so it was only the Brown decision in 54, the Emmett Till murder in 54, and then 55, and then, of course, Martin Luther King's emergence in the mid-50s, and the confrontation with Hoses and the Bull Connors of the world, where that made a great story, because conflict always is a fun and exciting story for the media. It makes it simple and cartoonish, this group against that group. And in Birmingham, where the initial problems occurred, there had been riots and bombs for 20 years. It was called Bombingham to a lot of people, and most of the national audience in America and most of the media had never covered that very closely, frankly. And so how much we know and when we know it and how deep we know it, deeply we know it, and all that has always been a problem, I suspect. Again, I've only looked in the last half century, but this book could have easily been two or three times longer.
Oh, yeah.
The first draft was 60,000 words longer, as a matter of fact.
I do think the Occupy movement was essentially created as a national phenomenon by the media covering police pepper spraying people in the face in New York City. But to the extent that they covered the movement and the protest, it was always from the point of view of the uninvolved citizen whose drive might be disrupted or who might be annoyed by the protesters who smell bad. It was never the way that it is when it's Iranians or it's a protest in Hong Kong that's happening now. It's where does that perspective come from, that the U.S. media is always against those exercising their constitutional First Amendment rights?
Well, the way it happens is the media has always been, and to some extent has to at least be in touch with those in authority, and those in authority control access. When there's a large demonstration, where do they get their crowd estimates? It used to be they would ask the government what the crowd estimate was, and if it was something the government was embarrassed about, of course, the numbers would be suspect, and then the media would actually have to do their own research. What a concept. And so basically a deference to power, and whoever says in officialdom what is happening, generally that's the story, and that's the news, and the it's certainly historic way news is covered. It's what those in officialdom say, and what ordinary citizens think is very nice. They'll do a poll But, you know, they will not, you know, and the poll will be useful, and they talk to 1,000 people if they can get them on the phone anymore. But, you know, the media, especially national news media, or covering in a state capital, for example, they're basically tethered to those in power and what occurs there, and that defines the news, unless there's a natural calamity like a tornado or some other incident that is a natural occurrence where, but you still need then, you need the firemen and the morgues to tell you how many dead bodies there are. So you're still tethered to those in officialdom telling you something. And I'm not, that's not an excuse, because obviously they're frequently incorrect. Either they just have a mistake that they've made with their numbers, or worse, they have an agenda. In that situation, we are the ones who suffer, because we get false information purveyed by the so-called fourth estate that's supposed to be a neutral observer watching all those in power, which is a nice idea, but it doesn't always happen.
We're speaking with Charles Lewis, whose book is 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. You describe in the book some of your efforts, successful at times, efforts to get stories that challenged power out on 60 Minutes and through other outlets. To what extent has the media, in particular the TV network media, declined since you were at 60 Minutes?
Well, yeah, I was there. I left in, but way back, you know, a long time ago, 35 or so years ago. I left in 2008, the end of 2008. And at, around that period, no, not 2008, sorry, 1988.
There's the math works better, yeah.
Yeah, sorry about that. 1988, and so, what, 36 years ago. Now, at that period in time, the apogee, the highest number of employees at TV network news operations, it was in the late 70s and throughout the 80s. However, starting in the mid to late 80s, the network started to retrench. Their audience was starting to slip, and they were already starting to recognize advertising revenue as a result was going down. And they also had voracious CEOs wanting to make, you know, astonishing profits. And so in the case of CBS, Lawrence Tisch, who owned the principal owner of CBS and also happened to be one of the major owners of a tobacco company, decided to fire 450 CBS employees, 25% of the network. And back in the 80s, the early 80s, CBS had 28 bureaus covering the world, and by today, something like today, we're around 5 bureaus, I think, on planet Earth outside the U.S. So the decimation of the capacity for all these TV news shows is pretty grim. When I was there at 60 Minutes, you produced 4 stories a year. Now the producers do 6 stories a year. Well, if you have less time to do a story, you're generally not going to do as good a story. And that means you're going to do so-called book reports, where you interview the author for a 60-minute segment that, you know, the good news for the author is it goes to millions of people. The bad news is it's a one-interview story that you could have done in a week, you know, instead of 3 to 4 months, which is how long the stories used to take. So that is happening across the board at all the TV networks and in television in general. Local TV, of course, as we all know, is pretty pathetic. They accept a lot of paid programming. But the number one source of news in America is actually local TV. And we all know that sports, weather, the latest murder, car accidents, that's generally the sensational fare that is offered up as local news. And less than 1% of their news is actually about politics, which is really irritating, to put it mildly, because they're getting wealthy from political ads, which have soared through the roof. And so if you want to get heard as a politician, you've got to buy ads on their stations, which is one of the reasons we have seen an explosion in the cost of our campaigns in the country. So there's all these seismic kind of systemic problems that go very deep that help explain what has happened to the media. That's just the financial and the numeric issues of, if you have fewer bodies, you have less coverage.
Yeah.
We have today the same number of reporters in America covering those in power in the U.S. as we did in 1972, the year of the Watergate break-in. The problem is we've added 100 million people, and the federal budget has gone up 18 times. So what needs to be covered is obviously far more complex and far more extensive than it was 40 years ago plus. And the number of people is just woefully inadequate. And that's not the only problem, obviously. But if you already have fewer reporters and more people, who's going to do all this research and reporting?
Yeah, it's not just fewer, though. It's a choice right. of perspective but, taken
well,
as well,
yeah,
right?
It's a simplicity that sets in. You got fewer people and you're on the run. People on local TV sometimes do 4 or 5 stories a day.
Yeah.
Also, the new media forms, if you've got to do 2 or 3 tweets that day and you've got to do radio piece as well as local TV piece, you're going to basically dumb down everything. Sound bites went from 40 seconds 20, 25, 30 years ago. Today, they're less than 8 seconds. How what can you say of any substance or merit for 5, 6 seconds? Like nothing.
I made a comment, I think, 3 years ago about how surveillance drones might violate our Fourth Amendment rights, and I read it this week in a CNN story that acted as if they'd spoken to me and put me on the side of opposing searching for a possible murder victim's body with surveillance drones when it was a completely unrelated topic and something I had said years ago, and they never talked to me. Is that how... I don't think that's how it was always done.
No, that's offensive and actually incredibly unethical on their part, especially if they placed you in the middle of a current controversy
they did.
You weren't even consulted about. That's just unprofessional, and whoever did that probably should be fired. Or at least in the old days, that's how you would expect something like that to happen.
Yeah. There are other influences as well. Of course, we've read just in the recent weeks about this former LA Times reporter, now AP reporter, who was running his stories by the CIA, getting their okay. I mean, we've known about this CIA in the media problem for quite some time. It doesn't come up in your book. Is that something you ever ran into?
I'm aware of it, and you know there are things I'm aware of that one of the problems with those kinds of things we're talking about is it's very elusive to have any proof. Like, you know, there are things you hear, like at the water cooler or over lunch or in a bar or something, talking to people when they kind of let their hair down, they're a little more candid. But it's hard. I'm a document guy. I don't know if you noticed, but I'm very. A lot of what I did, hundreds and hundreds of footnotes, source notes, I'm very into authentication of these things. I certainly am aware the major media, one of the issues in Washington, of course, is access journalism. And when you cover, there's only roughly 15 to 20 people at most cover national security in the United States full time as a job, that, you know, a professional paid job. That's in a country of 320 million people. So first of all, we don't have enough reporters. But second of all, getting an original story that is not somebody testifying about intelligence issues on the Hill, which is sometimes a public hearing, not always, it's just a very, very difficult thing to cover. Bureau chiefs of major media outlets have been known to, and that includes the major so-called elite newspapers, to talk frequently to, including the editors, not just the reporters, to folks in the highest levels, from the White House, including the president, sometimes all the way down to FBI directors, CIA directors, cabinet secretaries, national security advisors. And, you know, it is the idea of reading a story or running something by them is common. I mean, because they're very, very concerned that they will... do something that kills people and then have egg on their face. The so-called Abu Ghraib prison abuse issue back in 2004, I don't know if you recall this, but
sure.
Seymour Hersh and CBS broke that story, but CBS sat on the story for 2 weeks because Richard Myers, the then chief of staff to the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon, asked CBS not to broadcast because it would endanger soldiers' lives. And he met with them in New York, and they agreed to sit on it for 2 weeks. And finally, the network was getting very frustrated and impatient. And meanwhile, they knew Cy Hersh was going to break it and could care less about this. And of course, he worked for the New Yorker as a freelance writer. But And I'm sure there were some conversations, but no one ever called Cy Hirsch because they know what he would have done.
Yeah.
And in fact, he then, when they knew he was going to break it, they said, the hell with this, and they went on the air finally. And, of course, it was an incredibly important story. And, by the way, no one died because of that story. So,
and he's had to start going to British media now. I mean, he can't get his stories published yeah. in the United States at all.
The London Review of Books, I think, or something like yeah. that. He is, it's very unfortunate. I know Cy pretty well. I've known him for decades, and it's a sorry commentary when a journalist of his stature and caliber can't find a place to publish. But that is, in a way, a snapshot of what we're describing, where things are today.
Yeah. Speaking of documents, it was when we had a document that was called the Downing Street Minutes that that we made a real push for accountability for Bush's lies and Cheney's lies and the 935 that give the title to your book, which was a great production of yours, the list of 935 lies. But yet you say you're not sure if they knew they were lying, and that just floors me. I mean, here's a guy who chatted with Tony Blair. Let's paint a U.S. plane with U.N. colors and fly it low and see if they'll shoot at it, and then walked out to the podium and said, we're trying to avoid a war. It will be our last resort. And how is it possible to imagine that these guys didn't know they were lying?
Well, no. I mean, I have eventually, gradually, I try to give people the benefit of the doubt. I know that sounds quaint, but back then, you know, no one has actually interviewed any of the eight people we tracked with their false statements that added up to 935. Lies from 9/11 to 2 years after 9/11. And so no one has actually done a face-to-face interview on camera or off camera or any kind of recorded interview with anyone, with any of those eight people. And all their memoirs, they said they had bad intelligence, which of course is obscene, a ridiculous thing to say. But the fact of the matter is, there is a sentiment going back to like Aristotle that, you know, sometimes more dangerous than a lie is when people actually believe what they're saying. They've convinced themselves it's in the national interest and they believe it's good for America, and they actually come to believe things that are not true. What I'm getting at is, if I don't have a chance to talk to them, I started out with things, the book about truth in general, and then finally the publisher said, well, you've got this great thing you did, the Iraq War Card. This thing should be about 935 lies. And I had been very cautious in using the L word because I knew I would never get access to the White House. They hated me for some other things we had done. We posted all the Iraq and Afghanistan war contracts, among other things. That they hated, but there's other things too. When I ran the Center for Public Integrity, and I just knew that was not going to happen. So that was my way of standing back and having some degree, or at least attempting a measured judgment of calling it false and erroneous statements. When we first published what we called Iraq the War Card back in 2008 on the 5-year anniversary, mm-hmm. over time since then, over the ensuing 5 to 6 years, I came to generally become harden my position and decide they definitely were lying. But I was really trying to be cautious about that, because people do make a lot of accusations these days about everyone all the time, 24/7, to a lot of split screen blather on cable. And that, I'm not one of those people. I'm generally a cautious cat who reads documents.
So I want, before we run out of time, to sure. to question a hero rather than a goat. Edward R. Murrow comes off mm-hmm. as a hero in most tellings, and I think very rightly so, and very much so in your book, which is wonderful in telling his story of standing up to the pressure from Congress and the attacks and the red baiting and the McCarthyism. And yet you bring up in your story of how great he was the fact that he met with FDR hours after Pearl Harbor. Reportedly, he spoke to his wife and he spoke to colleagues that night and in the years that followed about how FDR had given him the biggest story in the history of his life and it could put his kid through college, but he wasn't sure if it was his duty to report it or to stay silent. And I would have thought it was a reporter's duty to report it, to tell the people?
It's a great question. I mean, I know what you're getting at there. It is a problem, you know, in that, but that is, that's a, basically epitomizes the problem with access journalism. The fact is, Murrow had become a celebrity, a huge celebrity, a global celebrity, but especially in this country. You know, he's met, his ship is met at the shores when he comes back in 41 after the Blitzkrieg and everything, and everyone wants to see him, and a big fancy dinner at the Waldorf Astoria. It's on, it's nationally broadcast, and he's on a speaking tour nationwide. And there was a social call type event where he and his wife were going to have dinner with Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. And then what happens is, it happens to be the day that the U.S. is attacked in Pearl Harbor by the Japanese, and the public is only just beginning to imagine what has occurred and not entirely knowing it, and he has not yet spoken to Congress the next day, I guess. And so this is where social and journalistic duty conflict, which is really what we're discussing. And it also goes back to the earlier conversations about phone calls and hobnobbing and have developing sources, including sometimes cabinet secretaries and high officials. You end up become a captive. It's like the moth and the flame. At some point, we know what happens to the moth. It's a problem. And I think, you know, it had to be a terrible dilemma for him. But I also talk about how the U.S. and the British, in the form of Churchill himself, wanted Murrow to work for the government because he was so effective in what he was doing about the cause of the war for both countries at that moment. And as Nicholas Lemon, who at the time he wrote it was the dean of the Columbia Journalism School, he wrote in the New Yorker, is at that particular moment, there was a synchronicity. The stars were properly aligned between what Murrow was reporting and what was in the U.S. and British interest. And he was the darling of officialdom. And in that context, yes, he definitely didn't know what to do about it. Was that a social thing? Was it a professional? He was not interviewing Roosevelt. They were having a sandwich after midnight.
Yes, but if Roosevelt told him, he knew this attack was coming, that they were provoking Japan for months and so forth, and he said, I'll keep quiet about that because of my national interest rather than my journalistic interest.
Yeah, no, I have a problem with that, obviously, but so I'm not defending Murrow. The guy was on, he was human, and he had blind spots, and that's clearly not what we know him for, and it's a huge issue, and I understand what you're raising there, and I share the concern about it. But it's almost every major journalistic figure that I've encountered has some sort of close proximity weakness or moment when they had to occasionally not report what they knew. I mean, it's unfortunate. I'm not defending it, but I have seen it, and it's not unique to Edward R. Murrow. Let's put it that way.
Absolutely not. And there are wonderful stories over the decades about these issues and where there is hope, actually, to turn things around in U.S. and world journalism. The book is 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. We've been speaking with Charles Lewis, who founded the Center for Public Integrity, and he is a professor at American University. Charles Lewis, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.